That's a major risk factor for both heart disease and cancer, and low-income counties might have worse preventive and medical care, making it harder for people to stay healthier or be treated for acute heart problems. Cancer, meanwhile, becomes more common the older we get, so the fact that people in high-income counties are starting to die more often from it is, strange enough, a sign that we're living longer. Dying, of course, is a zero-sum game. The less we die from one thing, the more something else will finish the job. But by highlighting these socioeconomic disparities, the team helps to bring more attention to ensuring everyone has a chance to live longer and healthier lives regardless of their circumstances. So money may not buy happiness, but would appear to help you live longer these days. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes.
NY2H for the comment.
Yes, Lou.
So, I'm getting of the age here where I'm looking at writing a living will, basically end-of-life care, and I'm reading a lot and I'm trying to make some decisions here. One interesting article I read said that most physicians really do not want any extraordinary heroic attempts at this time. I wonder if you have any opinions on that, Rory.
Well, unfortunately, like all things, it really depends. I've had examples of both ends of the spectrum. I've had people who had terminal cancer. They've had serious strokes. They have a negligible chance of surviving for something like a month, and yet family members hold on to prayers and such and miracles, and they want every possible thing done. On the flip side, I don't want to go into religion, but I had a Jehovah's Witness woman who was 25 years old who had a form of leukemia that lowered her platelet count. So she had her menstrual flow, and she couldn't stop it because she had low platelets, and because she was Jehovah's Witness, they would not allow me to transfuse her. So she basically bled to death on that alone. Now, she might have died of the leukemia months or whenever later, but that's a case in the opposite direction. So it's an individual type of a situation. If a person's quality of life is irreversibly gone, then I think extending something of a beeping machine is not very useful. But if there's a chance, there's a chance. So, you know, you don't turn things off when you can possibly fix things. So it's an individual type of a thing. I couldn't give you a simple solution to that.
Very good. I appreciate the info and the response. And, yeah, I mean, I'm reading all sorts of things here. And one company put out videos to try to dissuade people. You know, they talk about the elderly and if they don't have a do not resuscitate, they say chances are if they give you CPR, they're going to break your ribs. You know, and it some of the stuff isn't pretty. So, all right, maybe I'll flip a coin. Anyway, thanks. Thanks for the info.
Well, you're welcome, Lou. It's an interesting topic. It involves philosophy. It involves, unfortunately, religion. It involves a lot of other strange little nuances, and like I said, unfortunately, one size doesn't fit all. I mean, and hospitals are wary of being sued, so you know, they'll go with the loudest lawyer involved in the room. I had a patient who was a very nice elderly lady who had suffered a stroke, and she was pretty much brain dead. Her granddaughters were all lawyers. And so they brought all the legal forms, they filed them, they processed them, and I got the not-so-great job of carrying it out myself. I kind of felt it was my responsibility to do that. So, I don't know. I'm kind of wishy-washy one way or the other. The idea of my profession is to protect life, to continue life, but then is a lump of flesh with a respirator going deep life. So these are things philosophers dealt with, and as so has been mentioned already tonight, philosophers often end up having to drink poison, so I'm not going to go there.
Remember, yeah, continue, NY2H, clear.
Okay, on to another subject. Oh, for the good old days when no one was worried about poisons in the air or the water supply, when the world was clean and safe. But were the good old days ever so really good? Well, here's a little historical fact. About 250,000 years ago, two Neanderthal children were exposed to excessive levels of lead in what is now France, according to research. It's the oldest known case of lead exposure in hominid remains, a discovery that's asking an obvious question: how would this possibly have happened so long ago? A new paper published a few weeks ago in Science Advances sheds new light on the environmental conditions endured by Neanderthal children some 250,000 years ago. Ice age winters, as the new research suggests, had a profound influence on the health of young Neanderthals, and that's hardly a surprise, but the discovery of lead exposure among two Neanderthal infants most certainly is. Archaeologists made the discovery while conducting a chemical analysis of Neanderthal teeth uncovered at an archaeological site in southeast France. Teeth are like tree rings, chronicling an individual's history of chemical and environmental exposure. By studying the growth layers within ancient teeth, researchers can reconstruct the history of exposure during the first 3 years of life. Let me drop for a second. For the study, researchers analyzed the teeth of two Neanderthal children, labeled the specimens Pair 6 and Pair 336, who lived 250,000 years ago. These two teeth, both molars, were found sans skull, making it quite difficult to assess the overall health and conditions of these individuals. The tooth of an anatomically modern human child, designated Pair 1, was also analyzed. This tooth was found at the same site and dated to about 5,000 years ago. It wasn't possible to assign precise ages to the three isolated teeth, but they estimated that the Neanderthal first molar was only slightly worn and would have come from an adolescent, as adult Neanderthals show more worn teeth. The Neanderthal's second molar was more worn, and so they think this was more likely from a young adult. For the modern human first molar, it had not erupted or begun to wear down, and the root was incomplete, so it was likely that the child was around 5 years of age. First molars begin forming a few weeks before birth and continue until about the age of three, and second molars from about 3 to 6 years of age. They record the chemistry of what these individuals are eating and drinking as they mineralize within the layers of the teeth, which includes elements in the milk that they consume. Let me drop for a second. By measuring levels of barium, oxygen, and lead in the teeth, the team was able to track the children's exposure to various climatic conditions, foods, and chemicals at weekly intervals. In turn, this information was related to the children's health and rate of growth. This study reports a major breakthrough in the reconstruction of ancient climates, a significant factor in human evolution, as temperature and precipitation cycles influence the landscapes and the food resources our ancestors relied upon. The Pair 6 child exhibited elevated levels of trace element barium until 9 months of age, an observation consistent with breastfeeding. These levels dropped slightly and then remained moderate until the child reached the age of 2.5 years, at which time the barium levels dropped dramatically. This suggests a weaning age of 2.5 years, which is, interestingly, is the average age of weaning among pre-industrial human beings. Importantly, this is a very small sample size, so results need to be taken with a grain of salt. What's more, the Pair 336 Neanderthal did not exhibit the same barium spikes. They estimated that the second molar was formed between around 3 to 6 years of age, so it's possible the child was no longer nursing at that time. Alternatively, the tooth showed some environmental modifications, meaning the elements in the burial environment may have obscured the nursing signals. Now, this is a common complication of these elemental studies. Let me drop for a second. Further analysis of other Neanderthal teeth would help to clarify these findings. It's difficult to extrapolate Neanderthal nursing patterns beyond this one simple sample. By studying the oxygen isotopes in the teeth, the researchers were able to detect multi-year patterns in regard to environmental exposure. The Bear 6 Neanderthal child, for example, was born in the spring and was weaned in the fall. Mammals, including humans, show seasonal birth patterns that relate to environmental cycles, the authors write in the study. Our results for Bear 6 are consistent with broad mammalian patterns of bearing offspring during periods of increased food availability. Revealingly, both Neanderthal children experienced health problems, described by the researchers as developmental disruptions during the cooler periods. The stresses imposed by the Ice Age winter and the author's surmise took a toll on these young Neanderthals, who showed signs of sickness in the form of poorly developed tooth enamel during these periods. Remarkably, both the Pair 6 and the Pair 336 Neanderthals were exposed to lead on at least two occasions during their early life. This is considered the oldest documented exposure to lead in hominin remains. As to how these children were exposed to lead, the scientists can only speculate. Let me drop for a second. These high and acute lead lines are indicative of short-term exposure from ingestion of contaminated food or water or inhalation from fires containing lead, the authors write in the study. Lead can also come from mother's milk, but the divergent pattern of barium and lead in Pair 6 and the acute lead bands in both individuals would suggest that the mother's milk was not the primary source of the exposure. No level of exposure to lead is considered safe, but the health impacts can be subtle and sometimes delayed. Consequentially, the researchers aren't sure if the lead had any effect on their health of these Neanderthal individuals. The lead lines were high, in one case 10 times more than background measurements, but they did not cause any evident disruption in the teeth. They can't know if these exposures had any effect on brain development or cognition. It would be great to look at more prehistoric individuals from this region in France to see how common these exposures might have been. This exposure, the analysis suggests, happened during the cooler seasons. What's more, this part of France is known to be rich in mineral deposits. It's possible that the Neanderthals, while seeking shelter from the cold, ventured into caves, resulting in exposure. Traditionally, people thought lead exposure occurred in populations only after industrialization. But these results show it can happen prehistorically before lead had been widely released into the environment. The new study is fascinating, but it suffers from the same thing that afflicts so many other archaeological studies: insufficient evidence from which to draw robust conclusions. These new insights into Neanderthals, while revealing and even plausible, need to be supported by further archaeological evidence. And indeed, that's exactly what this team is headed for next. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. WS2N. Yes, Paul.
Yeah, maybe it came from volcanoes. You know, you have lead in the earth. At one time, lead used to be uranium. As uranium changes, loses all its neutrons and everything, eventually that becomes lead. You have a volcano, it could wind up in the water. You know, they're always drinking from the water in the old caveman days. Maybe that's how they got it.
Well, yes, Paul, it could be uranium decaying into lead. It could be simple lead deposits being on Earth. It could be lead deposits in the caves, which happens in France, where it somehow contaminates the cooking area or the food preparation area. But it's just an interesting indication that we worry so much about industrialized poisoning, and lead is probably the earliest. Everyone's heard the dubious story that the Roman Empire fell because they used the water systems that were lined with lead pipes, and they all suffered from lead poisoning and became crazy or stupid. I think that's an incredible simplification of the history of the Roman Empire. But nevertheless, we've always kind of thought that lead poisoning was an industrial era phenomena, and this kind of demonstrates that it happened to our Neanderthal cousins a quarter of a million years ago. Also, it's sort of fascinating that they could take a couple of little teeth and extrapolate how long the infant Neanderthals breastfeed, you know, 2.5 years. So I just thought it was a kind of a generally interesting topic to kind of get a sense of how you can flesh out people, I guess they're people, right, from a quarter of a million years ago just on the basis of a few teeth that they found. Okay, on to the next thing, and we're actually going back to something that's vaguely related to radio, so I'm sure that'll cause some people's ears to peak up. There's a new material announcement that might be close to you guys' heart, a spray-on antenna, if you will. Now, non-hams may not think much about that, but antennas are everywhere. In our phones, in our cars, in anti-theft tags, on clothes we buy, and as the Internet of Things become an ever more present reality, they're showing up in new places like microwaves and lamps. Engineers have therefore been looking for methods of making antennas smaller, lighter, easier to fly. Now, researchers at Drexel University have developed a method for creating nearly invisible antennas on almost any surface by literally spraying them on like paint. The antennas are made from a special two-dimensional metallic material called emexine. Emexine powder can be dissolved in water to create a paint that is then airbrushed on. In the sheets of paper, in tests, even a layer as thin as 62 nanometers, that's a thousandth of a time thinner than the sheet of paper, would communicate effectively. Performance maxed out at around 8 microns, the point at which the spray-on antennas work just as well as those currently used in mobile devices and wireless routers. The antennas are so thin they can be sprayed on without adding weight or bulk, even to tiny devices like medical sensors. And they're flexible too, meaning that they can go on non-flat surfaces like curtains. The researchers say that the antennas could make for huge improvements in wireless devices and the Internet of Things, especially when it comes to wearables. You could even spray on an antenna on your socks to keep track of them. Let me drop for a second. This will allow really wireless communications with any item, said one of the researchers involved. This could make a real difference because we're going towards a world where everything will be connected. So imagine being able to instantly apply an antenna to any item you own and make it a communications device. You could put an antenna on your dog's collar to keep him from getting lost. You can put one on your refrigerator so you can communicate with it by phone for whatever reason you might have. Put them on your tennis balls to monitor the speed of your serves. The research was published recently in the Journal of Science Advances. Unlike other nanomaterial, emexine doesn't require any binders or heating to adhere nanoparticles together. All it needs is to be mixed with some water and sprayed with an airbrush. The resulting antennas can even work on materials that are moving and flexing, such as textile. Though it will affect the reception much in the same way moving the antenna did on the old TV. To make antennas maximally useful, they'll need to be paired with the type of flexible electronics, think stretchable phones or roll-up tablets that don't exist yet. This is something many researchers are working on but have yet to come to fruition. The Drexel team tested the spray-on antennas on a rough material, cellulose paper, and a smooth one, polyethylene parathane sheets. They now plan to test it on other surfaces, including glass, yarn, and skin. Yarn antennas could make for connected textiles, while skin could have applications for veterinary or human medicine. They hope to partner with investors or commercial partners interested in developing products that could benefit from these antennas. The team is also looking at how to optimize the material in terms of conductivity, strength, and potentially making it even thinner and easier to spray on more precise shapes, as well as making it work at different frequencies. Let me drop for any questions or comments.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
WS2N, I want to see how they are going to attach these antennas, the electronic equipment. You know, are you going to use alligator clips?
and thought of it and stuff. I mean, I've got to see this. But like you said, the equipment isn't developed yet. What good is an antenna without the equipment to tie into this? Well, yeah, Paul, it's just one step in a great conga line. The apparently in some people's mind is they really, really want to have cell phones that could roll up. I'm not quite sure how incredibly useful that will be, but that's some guy's dream. They regularly at the Consumer Electronics Show, January, they will pull out the organic light-emitting diode displays that are made with a flexible base that you can roll up into a little scroll-like configuration. And so flexibility apparently is one of the big things, and they are working on flexibility of antennas, how they're going to make contact with this material, whether it's, I doubt it's going to be solder, but there are other technologies that they use to bond conducting material to each other, and they'll probably work on that. So, you know, brave new world and all that.
It would be good for a hotel. You'd bring your 2 meter radios, spray the stuff on the glass in the hotel, and attach to it. Now you have an antenna. You know, I mean, a lot of people have done that in hotels, more or less, with the tape. That, remember the alarm tape everybody used to have? Now you could just spray it on. That would be good.
Yeah, I'm sure that ultimately the technology will be of some value, because they'll always be looking for some kind of device where present technologies, antennas, are too bulky and such. But with RF chips and such, that probably will be developed for RF chips as well. Unfortunately, I'm reading articles where employers are chipping their employees. I don't know about you, but I would hate to be treated like Fido, because I'm aware that the dogs are regularly chipped, but I don't know if particularly I'd like to be chipped as well. Now, there are guys out there who've had RF chips placed subdermally, and they use it as an ID access as an experiment or to demonstrate a technology. But I don't know if I would like to be chipped personally, and I doubt that I know too many people who would. Okay, on to our next subject. Samsung, you know, the famous multi-billion-dollar company, has finally nailed a much-anticipated chip manufacturing technique that will help phones perform faster and keep their batteries juiced for longer. The company is now building seven nanometer chips using something called extreme ultraviolet technology. Process which has been in the pipeline for years but has faced all kinds of challenges in the real-world rollout. Chips are manufactured by using light to project patterns of circuitry into silicon wafers. The next generation of chips, however, have features that are smaller than wavelengths of a traditional light. It's a fat Sharpie where a thin ballpoint is needed, and manufacturers have tried various ways to get around this problem. Samsung, existing 10-nanometer and 14-nanometer chips, for example, are exposed to 193-nanometer wavelength light many, many times in methods called multi-patterning. Essentially, the same section of the die is written to several times. Now, researchers have known for a long time that EUV, extreme ultraviolet technology, has wavelengths of 13.5 nanometers is the answer, but machines can be even more expensive, and the technology issues have delayed high-volume production. Now, according to Samsung, two major challenges it's faced have been the power of the light source itself and the volume of the wafers that could be processed every day. But it says it's figured that out, and now it's getting set to commercialize chips that have a 40% smaller surface area compared to the company's previous 10-nanometer technology, while reducing power consumption by 50% or boosting performance by 20%. Samsung is already the world's biggest vendor of memory chips, but its innovation...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Sorry about that. Samsung is already the world's biggest vendor of memory chips, But its innovation here gives it massive leap ahead to competition, not the least of which because the company responsible for keeping Moore's Law going. The law indicates a doubling of transistors for a given chip every 2 years, but it's been slowing down in recent years. Moore's Law is important if we want to keep seeing smarter, faster technology. And since Samsung supplies a whole lot of that from their company, it won't be long before we're enjoying just that. So, just to show you that the fastest don't always end up winning the race, Intel has made more money than ever before, and they continue to suffer delays on their 10-nanometer chip fabrication facility. So, sometimes you could be slow and win the race. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes.
WS2N, do you know what they mean by 7-nanometer? I read this article, by the way, just when you sent it a couple of weeks ago. I did find something very similar to what you just said. But I don't get what they mean by 7-nanometer. You know, is that the distance from one transistor to another?
It's the smallest dimension that they can produce patterns on the silicon that are then doped to produce transistor elements and the other elements. As the number goes smaller and smaller, they're packing the components tighter and tighter. Ultimately, there's going to be a point where quantum mechanics is going to wreak havoc, and there'll be electron tunneling, which will complicate and ruin everything. So eventually, we will bang our heads at Moore's up against Moore's Law. But until then, the nanometer is the smallest dimension of any pattern that can be printed onto a printed circuit on a wafer of silicon.
And that's amazing how far they've come. I remember decades ago when they first talked about the chips they had. They laid it out, they set it on the floor of a large building, and then they would essentially take a picture of it from the ceiling looking down, and then from that they would be able to somehow inscribe that onto their chips. And now they're doing this. Very good.
Yes, I mean, those were the good old days. Nowadays, we need powerful computers to do this inside the computer because there's not enough surface area and there's not enough flawless photography to generate an analog version of this. And even some of the design for the chips is based on computer intelligence and some incredibly clever designers. I think there's two groups of Intel designers. There's a group in Israel and there's a group in the United States. And they've kind of squeezed a lot of functionality out of this design beyond anyone's imagination. And I hope they keep the ball in action because it gives us those nice shiny new toys to play with.
Okay, Samsung. Well, all right. I guess we're gonna have even smaller phones. Although it looks like everybody's phones are getting bigger. We went with the smaller phones down to the flip phones, and then now to the smartphones, and now everybody has cell phones that look like tablets. So I don't know what. Maybe we will need that other one where you roll it up and you put it into your pocket. You know, we will need that flex technology that you were talking about before. Combine that with the nano, ultraviolet 7-nanometer. Maybe you'll have something. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, Paul. Hopefully, we'll have something out of that. I think the size of the cell phone is more an aesthetic choice. At one point, it was a technology gag of how small could they make it, and they finally made it so small that it was impractical. People couldn't push the buttons, they couldn't make calls, they couldn't use it for anything, but it was very small. And so lately it's grown to be bigger and bigger. Personally, I think it's a little bit too big these days. I sort of like the slightly smaller form factor for myself. But the big benefit for high-density chips is that it requires less power and it, you can pack more processors into the same surface area, and you can speed them up. So you get, it's more efficient, and it's more effective, and you could do more things with it. So I think that's pretty much what's driving everything. I mean, right now, those little thumb drives are rather strange. You know, I remember when a hard drive, a 2 megabyte hard drive, would take up the size of a stack of books and cost you about $3,000. You can't even buy a thumb drive that has that small a capacity. Those hard drives back in the 80s and the early 90s easily were something ridiculous like 2 or maybe 20 megabytes. And now you can just go into any kind of electronic store and pick up a 16 or a 32 gigabyte thumb drive for next to nothing. So, you know, I mean, we all became a bit jaded, I think, unfortunately, but it's sort of nice to be in the golden age of the technology that we have. I mean, there might be other gold ages in front of us, but right now this one seems pretty good.
Yes, and just a few years ago, I remember going into Radio Shack. I think they had a sale for $4. I wound up with a 32 gigabyte thumb drive. You know, incredible. I'll let you continue, Roy. WS2N.
Okay, very good, Paul. I still remember my first computer was an Atari 800. It had an entire 48,000 bits of memory. There is no place that sells 48K of memory anymore. So just goes to show how incredible the last 30 years of technology has gone. Anyway, let me break for just a second, and then I'll move on to yet another topic. Okay, by the time you finish reading an average sentence, your brain will have rapidly assessed your surroundings 14 times to see if you should focus on something else. At least that's what new research suggests. This is a departure from the way we typically think our brain holds attention. Neuroscientists have suggested that neurons fire in a consistent stream when you're focusing on one thing. The new research suggests it instead has a kind of rhythm where neurons become less active 4 times per second. During these little blips, the researchers suggest your and my brain visually checks out its surroundings for something more important to pay attention to, like maybe something exceptionally threatening in a clumsy coworker about to douse you in hot coffee, or something interesting, like a dog in the office. Your brain's checking in on the rest of your environment to see if it should focus on something else, remarked one of the writers of the study. Not that it unfocuses per se, but to see if something else beats out your current focus. It would make sense that the brain works that way from an evolutionary standpoint to survive the world. You've got to be constantly aware of potential dangers. It's like if you're going after this shiny red apple in a tree and you want to know if something bigger or with sharper teeth is also going after that apple, the researchers said. Yeah, you're focused on the apple, but not so focused you don't see danger coming. Now, the researchers measured this hidden brain rhythm in both humans and macaques, as noted in a peer of studies published a few weeks ago in Neuron. Both studies had a near identical setup and included both humans and macaques who had electrodes implanted in their brain. The humans, of course, had received theirs as part of an epilepsy treatment. It wasn't just an experiment. Either a monkey or a human sat in front of a computer screen and was instructed to focus at the point.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I'm obviously talking too much. A camera monitored eye movements, so trials were thrown out if subjects shifted their gaze, which implied they also shifted their focus. Then, very faint, nearly undetectable, horizontal or vertical rectangles were briefly flashed on the screen. If a monkey detected the shape, it pulled a lever. The macaques had previously been trained on this setup and rewarded with juice for successful lever pulls. If a human detected the shape, he or she released the computer mouse button they'd been holding down. Throughout the trials, researchers used electrodes to measure the brain activity. Now, after analyzing the data on how the brain's neurons behaved while persons or macaques were focusing on one thing, the researchers saw near-identical dips in neuron activity at a frequency of 4 times a second in both the monkeys and the humans. That extreme similarity across species could mean that this brain rhythm exists in other primates as well. At the very best, it's a good validation that monkey studies on attention and brain activity can be translated to humans. The monkey is the typical animal model for understanding attention, a researcher said. I can't think of another example where it's in humans with the same exact study. Neural activities we discovered in monkeys should be true in humans, and this is a rare case where we have verified that. Let me drop for a second. But the fact that only people with epilepsy were included in the study is a definite limitation. The researchers did point out, though, that because results were so similar between humans and monkeys, it's likely that the results would also be similar between humans with and without epilepsy. Continuing to understand these brain rhythms could be useful for study attention deficit disorders. The team speculated that people who get hyper-focused or very easily distracted at the hands of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder might be getting stuck in one of these two states of neuron activity described in this paper. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next subject. Well, let's see. Two subjects seem to make the news in the field of science almost every week. The wonder material graphene and the latest, greatest battery technology. Now, sometimes the two subjects merge together into one story about a graphene-based new battery technology, but tonight the news is about improvements in a very promising technology of zinc air rechargeable batteries. You might be familiar with zinc air power cells that can be stored for long periods of time and activated by breaking that seal and letting the atmospheric oxygen into the power cell to get the power started. These long-term storage cells are not actually rechargeable, but the dispensed battery chemistry can be swapped out for a new supply reusing some parts of the original zinc air battery. The holy grail here is the possibility of a low-cost, high-efficiency rechargeable zinc air battery. Over the past 6 years, 110 villages in Africa and Asia received their power from solar panels and batteries that used zinc and oxygen. The batteries are the basis of an innovative energy storage system created by something called Nant Energy, a company owned by Patrick Sun-Seung, a biotech entrepreneur and a surgeon originally from South Africa. Let me drop for a second. Now, back in the good old days, Thomas Edison tried to develop batteries made with zinc. That was 100 years ago, but he did not figure out how to make them technologically viable. Nant Energy says its zinc air technology is the first to become commercially available. The scientists there said they achieved two key goals: to make the batteries rechargeable and to lower their cost for energy storage to about $100 per kilowatt hour. That figure is that some people in the industry have said is essential to creating a carbon-free electric grid that operates even when the sun is down and the wind abates. The zinc air batteries are one of the several potential alternatives to lithium-ion batteries, which have been the focus until now for large-scale power storage and electric vehicles. Dr. Sun-Seung, whose company gets its zinc from Indonesia, has cited the mineral's abundance. The United States accounts for about 5% of the world's zinc reserve and 7% of its production, mostly from mines in Alaska. Australia and China have about half the world's reserves and are among the largest producers. Reserves of lithium, a primary element in lithium-ion batteries, are 1/20th those of zinc. At the present rate of production of zinc, some experts believe that zinc reserves will last about 25 years. So it's not clear from the reserves available if we have enough zinc to support an enormous need that will result from the demand of grid-scale batteries. Let me drop for a second. Materials like lithium are costly in part because they are rare. The mining of lithium has also threatened the health and safety of workers in areas where it's been plentiful, like the Democratic Republic of Congo. Prolonged exposure to lithium has been associated with health effects, like fluid buildup in the lungs. Lithium ion batteries can also pose a fire hazard as well. Zinc air batteries lack toxic compounds. They are not flammable and can be disposed of safely, according to MIT's technology review. Still, the mining and processing of zinc does present hazards. It comes from an ore consisting of zinc sulfide, and it's usually produced in conjunction with lead, cadmium, and nickel, and large-scale production can raise environmental issues from sulfur dioxide and cadmium vapor release. Dan Riker, an Assistant Secretary of Energy in the Clinton administration, cautioned that the battery's cost per kilowatt hour depended on the application and the scale, making useful comparisons very difficult. Let me drop for a second. Energy said that at $100 per kilowatt hour, the cost of zinc ear batteries compared favorably with that of lithium ion batteries, which can be $250 per kilowatt hour, but are more typically $300 to $400 per kilowatt hour. Even at $100 per kilowatt hour, energy storage remains a significant expense for the utility industry. Although batteries have been declining precipitously in price and are expected to become as common as residential solar panels in the next few years. NAND Energy said that its immediate focus was on delivering its products for microgrids, self-contained solar power arrays serving small areas, rather than on individual residential customers or utility-scale systems. But the company anticipates supplying the batteries for home users of the future in California and New York at first. Villages and islands using batteries and packs the size of briefcases typically connect them to solar arrays the size of the kind of canopy that might be found over a parking lot at a school. In addition, the batteries provide power to hundreds of communication towers, a significant part of NAND Energy's business. For the next version of the product, the company plans to add transportation systems like electric cars, buses, trains, and scooters. And beyond that, well, they said we have a first prototype of a mobile radio. Dr. Sun Cheung said we don't want to overpromise, but the energy density of our battery makes it really possible. Will this be the ultimate battery technology? Stay tuned. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes. Okay, on to the next story. Technology that will conserve energy is often a topic for recent material research findings. Recently, a new slant on the concept of a simple white paint was advanced. Researchers from Columbia University had a novel solution for cooling buildings. One, they said, that could help reduce the burden of climate change. It's a white paint. Technically, it's a polymer coating that uses infinitesimally tiny holes to cool the air. The coating is an example of passive daytime radiative cooling, where a surface cools down by reflecting sunlight and heat back into the atmosphere. A white paint, which reflects light, has long been used for passive daytime radiative cooling, but they usually contain pigments that also absorb light, and they reflect longer solar wavelengths imperfectly. In contrast, the coating developed by the Columbia team has a foam-like surface full of nanoscale holes. To create it, the researchers basically took the pigment from the white paint and replaced it with these tiny holes. This, in turn, the normally transparent polymer white. The holes scatter and reflect all wavelengths of sunlight, making the coating far better for passive daytime radiative cooling than traditional paints. Traditional white paints typically reflect only 85% of total sunlight, but absorbs the rest and heats up, said one researcher involved in the article in the journal Science. In contrast, the coating we developed reflects 96 to 99% of the total sunlight, ultraviolet, visible, and infrared, which is remarkably high and can remain below ambient temperatures even when sunlight is strong. Let me drop for a second. Other scientists have used similar solar reflecting methods to achieve cooling, remarked a scientist not involved in this article. The novelty of the work lies in the selection of this very simple method for forming films that achieve the passive cooling effect. Because the method is so simple, it could be relatively easy and cheap to produce and apply on a large scale. The coating could, for example, be manufactured in large rolls and applied like wallpaper. The coating works best in sunny climates. The study found it reduced heat by 11 degrees Fahrenheit in Arizona desert, but also functions well in foggy or more tropical environments. It reduced heat by 5 degrees Fahrenheit in Bangladesh. This means it could be used in vastly different settings around the world. The coating is easy to apply, essentially working like standard paint. It can be used on almost any surface, from rooftops to water tanks to vehicles. The team also experimented with making the coating in different colors in hopes of making the product appeal to a wider audience. Now, adding color does lower the degree of cooling, but the performance is still better than the colored commercial paint. Let me drop for a second. The researchers are now focusing on using water or alcohol-based systems to make coatings with similar cooling properties, which could make the product eco-friendlier and easier to apply. They're also looking for a new way to recycle discarded polymers. The team hopes that that the coating could eventually be used in places from deserts to tropical regions to places with intermediate climates, essentially anywhere where heat is more of a problem than cold. It could also be useful in a wide variety of economic situations. In a resource-rich setting, the coating can reduce air conditioning costs. In a resource-poor setting, where electrical cooling is unaffordable or unavailable, for example, in rural South Asia or Africa, the sub-ambient cooling can give relief and save lives. The coating, if used on enough buildings at once, could also help deal with so-called urban heat islands. These are urban areas that get much hotter than the surroundings thanks to close-together buildings and lots of human activity. As the world continues to urbanize, these heat islands are becoming an increasing problem. Heat waves kill a disproportionate number of city dwellers each year. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I fear that I might have caused some of you to take a nap, but I want to thank everyone for their participation and thank them for listening to this, and come next week, I will come up with a new list of scientific discoveries that will amaze and surprise everyone. And just want to reflect that I think this is going to be Science Talk 52. So this is my one-year anniversary, and it's been a fun year. So I think it's time for the Space Report with Paul. So please take it away. Paul, 1 second, though. I just want to, again, tell the audience the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all these articles will be on my website, roy.ac2gs.com. So over to you, Paul.
WB2GXM with a comment.
Oh, okay. And by the way, I have you at 53, Roy. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, 52, 53. What's this one between friends? GXM wanted to make a comment.
Thank you, Paul, for holding off just a second. This is WB2GXM, Rich. Just want to make one small, quick comment. Dick and I have talked about this before. My father passed away 2 years ago, December 15th. And in keeping with the spirit of the coming holiday, I would like to thank Dick, Roy, Eric, Paul, and John Beck for helping me get through the past 2 years. I don't think I would have made it without your company every Sunday night. WB2GXM clear.
Thank you very much, Rich. For myself, it was my pleasure. I enjoy these things immensely, and I'm glad that other people get something out of it as well. And I'll leave it to Dick and Paul to make their comments.
Yeah, very good, Rich, and with the help of you guys listening and asking questions, that's one way to keep it going. Help others as well. I'm sure Dick is still there. KTRIWWS.
Yes, I was away for a little while. Sorry. What did I miss?
Dick, just the fact that you and your entourage have helped me through the past 2 years, as I have expressed to you in the past. WB2GXM.
Sounds like we're getting a moderately good report card. Okay, are we ready for the space report? And that was Science Talk number 52, which means you said you were there a year. And one way of counting, you were there exactly a year. But back to you for a comment on that. Right.
Thank you, Dick. And I just want to repeat myself that it's been a very fun year. And hopefully it'll get to be even more fun as time goes on.
Okay. So, Paul, this is going to be space report number 323, I believe. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, T2RIW.
Yeah, I'm 324, and I've got Roy at 53, so I don't know. Somehow I gained a week. Very good, Dick. And I have you at 1,724. Each week, it just goes up one on the computer. So, unless somebody's absent, which we don't seem to be absent lately. It's ongoing. A lot happened this week. You know, most weeks you have one or two launches worldwide. This week we had five different launches since the last time we were on last Sunday. But most importantly, I want to talk about InSight, which is going to be happening this Monday at 3 o'clock. InSight will be landing on Mars, and I think that is really the breaking story for this week. We'll talk about the other five launches in a minute. But InSight launched last April, now arriving at Mars. Going to go through its EDL. Entry, descent, and landing very shortly. Once it starts that, it takes about 7 or 8 minutes before it actually lands on the surface of Mars. InSight, the name of it is the acronym for Interior Exploration using Seismic Investigations, Geodesy, and Heat Transport. The InSight lander is scheduled to touch down around 3 p.m. November 26th, and that would be 3, you know, we'll be able to actually watch at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the NASA network, however you get that. I have an app on my tablet, and I have it set up on the computer for NASA TV. You can always go to their website and bring up NASA.com, and it's going to say to view our click on here and you can get to it that way. So it should be interesting. It'll be live. Since Mars is right now only about less than 100 million miles away from us as the crow flies, it will be a little bit less than 8 minute transmission, about an eight minute transmission from Mars a year. Depending on the location, you can get up to 20 minutes depending if it's further away. This one's going to be very close. Should know, hopefully, right away if the Marco satellites are operating, which right now they are. Marco are the two satellites that were released from the second stage, the aft stage of the aft part of the second stage, right after it was launched last April. And now these two satellites, the Marco A and Marco B, have been following the InSight cruiser all the way to Mars ever since. So they'll be following directly behind it. So when InSight goes down for a landing, the Marco sat should be about 2,000 miles behind it. So they'll have their antenna, their UHF antenna, pointing straight down to the planet to receive the transmissions from InSight as it goes through the descent and landing. And since it's really a crossband repeater, essentially what these satellites are that are following it, Marco will transmit immediately from UHF to the X-band, and then X-band will be going back to the Deep Space Network. In this case, it's going to be Madrid, Spain. There are three main sites, 120 degrees, set apart on Earth, and believe Madrid, Spain will be the in line at the time, and then they in turn will transmit the information over to California to Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where the teams there will be waiting for insight to phone home. If the CubeSats don't work, the CubeSats that he's essentially there's six CubeSats put together. Each CubeSat is 10 centimeter cube, so that gives you an idea of the size of these things. When they open, when they first opened up at the launch, two solar panels came out, and they've been facing the sun ever since. And then the X-band reflector part of the antenna that had to open up, and it's got a lithium battery on board that's being recharged by the solar cells, and it's got little very tiny thrusters on board. Eight thrusters on each satellite. It's being fed from one tank of, essentially the same, similar stuff that you would find in a fire extinguisher. So nothing igniting, it's just pressure when it's released. But then to do fine tuning to make the satellite just move just so, they use the, they have momentum wheels, three of them inside each one, you know, that will spin up, move the satellite one way or the other. And since they're working, we should get immediate results on if this thing was successful. So if you happen to be off on Monday, if you have, I know the people in the educational world, a lot of schools will close for Monday or Tuesday. Some of the, you know, if you're off and you get a chance to see this at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, if not, you'll be able to watch, I'm sure, replays on NASA. There's some of this will make it to the news. And once in a while, you'll see a documentary dealing with these topics. So we'll be landing at Epsilonium. Well, I think it's Planetina, Planitia, Planitia Elysium. It's basically a big flat area. They say it's like landing in a Walmart parking lot. Most of these Mars landings, the geologists and scientists, they always wanted to get near a mountain or a crater or a volcano. They wanted to get into the middle of nowhere, as flat as possible. And they picked the perfect spot for that. And the reason for it is to be able to put down a seismometer, transmitter, which is going to dig its way into the surface, hopefully down about 15 feet. The seismometer will sit on the surface. But to do this, they needed a flat area. They didn't need any rocks in the way. They have these things sitting on the top of the InSight. InSight has a robotic arm, and the only job for the robotic arm is going to be to pick these things up and put them on the surface. So the last thing they needed was a big rock in the way to stop that from happening, or worse than that, a big rock in the way preventing them from opening up a solar panel. They have these big fan-like solar panels that are going to be circular, about 12-foot diameter, two of them, which will be giving them, I think, 400 watts or something of power to operate. The X-band transmitter will be on in the beginning, also to be able to make sure that the lander comes through. If the satellites don't work, we should be able to receive some kind of signal, either UHF or X-band. But right after they land, they'll be taking pictures, a panoramic view of the whole area, and they'll know right away if they landed in a good spot. It's only about 4 degrees off the equator this way. They know that the sun will be directly hitting the panels for the whole time that mission is planned for. It's really a 2-Earth-year mission, but that's really like a 1-year mission as far as Mars is concerned. It's roughly a 2-to-1 ratio. So we'll have to see how this works out on Monday. Hopefully the two Marco satellites work out good and InSight gets down to the ground. The cruise stage will separate first, and then after that the cruise stage will go in solar orbit. And the lander itself weighs around 850 pounds. So after that separates,